Okay, how about one more frustration, and then I'd like to have you generate 10 ideas in 10 minutes.
Keeping customers loyal, getting repeat. See, but again, this is all predicated on the same thing. Most people, even the uttering of frustrations, people were telling you what they want as opposed to what they want to do for others. How do you keep people loyal? Think about the people in your lives that you have the greatest loyalty to. And I guarantee it's because they have the greatest commitment to you. You're not loyal to somebody who treats you like a piece of excrement. You're not loyal to somebody in your personal life who doesn't love you. You're not loyal to an advisor who doesn't call and give you advice and direct you and protect you and worry about you. Are you?
No.
But all these people who lament their frustration, they want for them, but they don't give to others. I mean, there's no. It's so simple, it's almost embarrassing. You want 10 ideas?
Yeah. Give us 10 ideas in 10 minutes or so.
Okay. First idea I'll give you is, whenever possible, don't pay for advertising. Don't pay for salespeople. Don't pay for marketing. Pay for results. And by that I mean whenever you get the chance, convert everything you do to a performance base. I think it's sort of like an idea we gave on another one, but this is different. If you go to a radio station and they say, I want you to spend $5,000 a month, instead of saying, I don't have the budget, ask yourself, how many customers would I have to sell? Or what is my allowable, allocatable marketing cost that I can spend to acquire a new customer or to acquire a qualified prospect? And then divide that by the amount of money they want you to spend and say, look, I'll give you something better than that. I'll spend more than $5,000 as long as the expenditure can correlate to a maximum allowable cost of blank per customer. If you'll run that amount of money, I'll keep track. We'll have some offer that directly correlates to a specific type of customer so I can track and correlate and identify where business comes from. But I'll give you so much a customer against that. If you do more, I'll give you more. If you do less, I'll give you less and convert it. If a salesperson wants $10,000 a month, ask yourself how many, if you don't have commission, how many new customers, how much sales has to be done, and correlate it to something that's performance-oriented. If somebody wants to advise you on something, correlate it. One time I had a funny story. An advertising agency came to us. We were spending, and one of my clients was spending about $1 million a year on advertising. And the advertising agency came to us and said, in essence, give us the $1 million expenditure you're spending yourself. And I said, why? And they didn't have a good answer. And I said, I'll give you something better than $1 million. I'll give you a chance to spend $5 million. I'll give you a $10,000 trial advertising budget. I'll tell you what my allowable cost is. I'll increase that by 50%, so it's 1.5 times my normal allowable cost. And if you can spend that $10,000 any way you want, as long as it's approved by me, and it brings customers in up to or below that allowable cost, I'll keep spending every dime it comes back in with you. And you can keep parlaying up, and you can parlay it to $10 million, and they wouldn't do it. I used to be solicited all the time by religious groups.
Okay.
And I had a religious group that came to me that I actually had interest in. They wanted me to make a cash donation. And I said, I won't do that, but I'll do something many times better. I will write a full-page ad for you to run in the major newspaper. That ad will seek to get people to make donations to the cause that you're all about. I will fund the first running of the ad, and then you can basically, if it works, it'll keep building, and whatever comes in, you keep rerunning ads with, and it'll keep growing. And instead of getting a $25,000 donation from me, the effort and the $10,000 funding will produce maybe $1 million, and they wouldn't do it. They couldn't understand it, but it's simple. Make everything have to perform, Marty. Does that make sense?
It makes a tremendous amount of sense. My feeling is not everyone wants in on that.
But, I mean, that's your advantage. I mean, if everyone did, then there would be no advantage in seeing this.
Yes, yes.
You're asking me for ideas. See, yes. The beauty of what I do is you have the right. My whole take on life is you have an obligation to know what's possible, what you are entitled to, how much more you can get from a day, from an effort, from an opportunity, from an investment. If you consciously decide to restrict or constrain or limit the benefit, the payoff, the profit you give yourself, as long as you know what is possible, that's your entitlement. I was using an example. In other words, if you know you can buy certain kinds of secure income-generating investments and it could produce an 8% yield, but you're content having your money in a U.S. savings bond making 3%, as long as you know that there's 7% you're leaving on the table that's almost as secure and you refuse to do it, that's fine. But if you don't know about it, I think that's grievous.
All right. All right. How about that was a great idea. How about idea number two?
Number two, whenever you're dealing with people in advertising, in selling, in letters, deal with them in a humanized way. Deal with them and make sure it's you talking to me as a human being. As a human being, respect my intelligence and explain the reasons why everything you do. Take me in on the method to your madness. Tell me what you're doing, why you're doing it, what you're trying to accomplish. Respect me and my intelligence, and I will respect you and bond to you at a much higher level.
Application, or an example of that?
A lot of companies, when they're trying to sell things, when they're in a bind, they don't basically explain the bind to people. And they just will run an ad that'll say sale, or an ad that'll say overstocked or something like that. I had a retailer one time, I ran an ad that said, I goofed. I bought too many pieces of last year's styles in anticipating a warmer summer, and it didn't come. I'm sitting with so many unsold pieces that I've got them in the back room and in a warehouse. All of the fall merchandise is coming in about 2 weeks in two semis, and I don't have anywhere to put them, so I have two choices. Number one, rent an expensive warehouse from some really cutthroat warehouse person who could care the least about me and spend all that money and storing all the summer stuff until next year, or take the money I would have spent, reduce everything by that amount, pass the value on to you, knowing I will lose money on the transaction, but by sharing the honesty of the situation, hoping I will incur your goodwill, give you enough of a value that you will reciprocate it by buying my new merchandise, because it too will be on display, and helping me out of a problem. He sold all his merchandise in a few days.
Okay.
But he explained, he respected their intelligence.
Okay. Idea number three.
Let me give you a really good one on this one. Idea number three is, wherever and whenever you are engaged in a selling transaction, always reverse the risk. Always ask yourself, how can I take the risk or the reticence away from the transaction? And ask yourself, too, how can I help somebody preview the transaction or sample the transaction before they go forward?
Okay.
It's wonderful.
Sampling, a great idea. Number four.
Don't be afraid if it's a really good sale. Sometimes by changing the dynamics of the transaction, you can make a lot more sales. In other words, I've conducted probably $50 million worth of training programs that are so outlandishly priced. My least expensive program is $5,000. My most expensive is $25,000, which is a lot of money for 3 to 5 days with me, isn't it?
Right.
But I sold $50 million, and the way I've done it is by changing the terms. When people sign up, they send me a nominal good faith check that I normally don't deposit for 10 days. During that 10 days, I send them a lot of materials for them to preview and give them an education and an intellectual profit before I even deposit their good faith deposit. After they do that, I let them come and sit through a couple days before I consider their participation binding, and if they're uncomfortable for any reason, they get to leave and get their good faith deposit returned to them instantly. If they stay, I allow them to pay most of the purchase after they have gone home, so that theoretically, if they apply what I've taught them, I'll be paying for the purchase for them out of a fraction of the profit they make from the things I've shared with them.
Okay.
And it's an easy way for people to easily be enthusiastic about paying $5,000 or $10,000 or $25,000 for something that most people, if I said write me a check up front, wouldn't pay for.
Okay, and so the principle again would be?
Change the terms and the dynamics of the deal. If you know, as long as it's secure or you know you won't get burned, there's a company that does $60 million in product sales because they don't send anybody a bill. Most people want you to send cash up front. This company has got very deep pockets and a lot of history with their customers, and they know that if they let the customer sample the wear and bill them later, they'll get so much more. Great examples like the Columbia Record Club or the book clubs or many of the like the Franklin Mint. They have found that by giving people deferred payments or breaking the payments into installments and taking the risk on them and letting them pay for something after they've had the pleasure, a lot more people are enthusiastic and afford it, or at least rationally say, hey, if I don't like it, I haven't paid for it. If I like it, I can enjoy it or profit from it as I'm paying, and that profit will help me pay for it.
Okay.
It's a whole different way of looking at your business.
Okay. Number five?
If at all possible, add a direct mail division to your operations. People don't realize that if you can write a great letter, it can be the perfection of sales persuasion and sales presentation at concert pitch. Every month, if you mailed out 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 letters, it's like having 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 tireless, indefatigable, perfect salesmen and women knocking on doors 24 hours a day, 52 weeks a year, holidays included, going into people's homes, making the perfect pitch, not ever being tired, not ever taking time off, not ever forgetting a pitch, not ever not having a good response, because it's the perfection of presentation embodied on paper, and it's the most cost-effective. You're paying 50 cents a call, and it's the most powerful compliment. It's the most powerful means of penetrating new markets. It's the most powerful means of bringing new customers aboard. It's the most powerful means of expanding dramatically the impact, the influence, and the profitability of an operation to add a direct response or a mail order division to what you're doing.
Okay, great idea. Number six.
When you do that, always add telephone selling behind it. Recognize that telemarketing is a wonderful multifaceted service you can add to any business. You can use it in about 10 different ways. Number one, it can be used in post-sales follow-up, meaning after the sale you can follow up to maintain goodwill, and you can almost always sell a fraction of the people something else or a bigger unit of sales, so it can be a profit center. Number two, you can use it as a very powerful closing device behind a mailing letter, as we talked about in another program. Number three, you can use it as a lead generating process. Number four, you can use it as a means to penetrate markets not normally accessible by a full-time sales force. Number five, you can use it to pre-alert people to programs and mailings going out. Number three, you can use it for specialized offers of items or products that are not appropriate to sell to the masses, or that you have to pre-sell before you can ever afford to order them. It is a wonderful device that you must use.
You gave us a whole bunch of ideas there. How about just two more?
Okay, whenever you have a purchasing opportunity with a customer, always try to lock them in on as far in advance on sales. I think I talked about this before, but I'll talk about it a little differently. If you know the product or service that you sell is one that has the capacity of being highly repetitive, and if you know that by repeating it, the quality and the benefit and the advantage that's going to accrue to the customer is going to be greater, you have an obligation, this concept of a higher causal purpose, to do them a greater service by showing them that they'll benefit more and giving them an incentive and an inducement for wanting to commit to buy ongoing. And if you take the risk away and say, look, I'd rather give you a better deal. Right now you're spending $200 buying this shirt one time. How about if I give you 10% off if you'll guarantee to buy at least 10 shirts a year from me, and give you 10% off every one of those, and I alert you when they come, and I hold those shirts off the market so you make sure you get the best of the special ones, the exclusive ones we come in. And if you decide not to, I'll charge the difference if you don't buy the 10. But right now, I want to give you the benefit because I want to presume you're going to do that. That's not threatening.
All right. One more idea.
I think the biggest idea that I can give anybody is to go outside of your industry and pick the minds, study the success processes and methods of people outside of your industries, because that's where your greatest breakthroughs will come from, Marty.
Okay. Jay, thanks so much. If you could put a bumper sticker on every car in America for Wizard's Edge subscribers in the next month, what would that bumper sticker read as we go today?
It would say, ask yourself what's possible. What about what someone else is doing could I do in my business? And I just basically, I think this concept of extrapolating is really a powerful one, Marty.
All right. Talking with Jay Abraham, the Wizard, on The Wizard's Edge. Thanks for listening. We'll look forward to talking to you again next month. This is Marty Stacey. Have a great month. Bye-bye. Welcome once again to The Wizard's Edge with the Wizard himself, marketing genius Jay Abraham. This is Marty Stacey, Communications Director. Jay, describe what happens to your conference attendees and to your consultees after you have introduced them to the way you think. How do they go on with life after they start succeeding?
Well, the most wonderful thing about this is it has nothing to do with technique. It's a mindset. It's a way of looking at life. It's a way of looking at opportunities. It's a way of looking at possibilities. It's a way of looking at interacting with humanity. It's a way of looking at relationships, at communication, at as ideas being real, tangible mechanisms to get you accomplishment, to get, you know, to make impact. And when you start looking at life with that kind of a discipline, it changes massively, massively. The joy factor, the accomplish factor, the purpose factor, the dimension, the passion, the conceptual thrill of being part of the process of creating commerce, and I think it's just a whole different transformation. Also, you have an enormously great resurgence of passion for just the process of living. You find more joy in interacting with people, all kinds of people, from employees to customers to suppliers to husbands to wives to children to neighbors to nature. I mean, it's going to sound a little metaphysical, and I don't mean it to be, but it really does have that kind of a profound transformation to people who really allow it to pervade them.
So the concepts don't just necessarily even stay within business. They wash over into other areas.
Absolutely. It is a mindset. It's a mindset that is all-encompassing. It's a mindset that absolutely takes over and absolutely, if you allow it, will fuel your capacity to achieve so many higher levels of accomplishment, of fulfillment, of impact, of contribution in society, in the world, in your life, and it makes it easier and more fun. I mean, it's almost hilarious. I think on one of our previous programs we were talking about why in the world you do things any other way when there's so much more to be gained for so much less effort, risk, frustration, negativity, but that's really what it is. It's basically, it's giving yourself the ultimate upside in life and lowering the downside, pain, risk, loss, or non-joy factor by almost totally. It's pretty neat.
One of the things that I have learned from working with you is the value of understanding the past, where marketing and advertising have come from. How about a quick overview of someone or something that is very significant in the recent past?
Well, I've studied all these old masters, and they've had an incredible impact on me. David Ogilvy was a master, and he still is a master. I think he's like 85 and still alive. And he's a master because he refused to do anything that didn't produce direct results. He stood for only communicating with people if the communication could evoke a result, if it could compel somebody to action as opposed to just being passive or non-valuable to them. Claude Hopkins, I talked about yesterday or the day before on a previous program. One of the other things he stood for was the scientific method. He refused to make any decisions based on conjecture because he understood that his approach and his take may not be the way the markets was, so he asked questions. He asked the market questions. If you learn to ask your marketplace questions, what price is best? What premise is best? What benefit do you most want? What guarantee appeals most to you? By testing, the market will always tell you the highest price to charge, the best proposition to make, the best headline to use, the best premise to use, the best risk reversal to use. You will become a marketing genius if you but turn the answers over to your customer base and your marketplace and stop trying to make the decision by conjecture. He was very good at that. There's a really interesting story, and I may have told it, I may not, about James Webb Young, who was the creative director of J. Walter Thompson in its really heyday years. He discovered in his work with advertising mediums, newspapers, publications, that when you sold ideas, people bought in droves. When you sold things, few people bought. So the concept is people come alive when you give them an idea. People come alive when you put the whole utilization process together. People come alive when you show them how to do something, why to do something, what the result would be, and possible applications. This has universal implication. Someone else whose name I honestly can't remember, but who was the founding head of one of the larger agencies in New York in its heyday, got started with a very simple premise. Everybody basically makes a critical mistake in marketing and selling and trying to solicit customers. They basically, they don't directly or literally say this, but their message indirectly or implicitly says, give me the business you're currently giving to somebody else. But most people forget that there has to be one additional critical ingredient, and that is the reason why or the because. In other words, why should you give me the business you're giving to someone else right now, Marty? If I can't give you a better reason why, and that reason why must have self-serving benefit to you, you're probably not inclined to make a transfer of business over to me, are you?
No, because really it sounds like a plea for charity.
But that's what most people's overtures to the marketplace and to prospective customers are. They are pleas for charity. They're basically saying between the lines, please, please, please take pity on me because I have no other benefit to offer you. And that's why they don't do very well with their marketing, with their selling, and with their promotions. You've got to always be mindful of the fact. The more critically you can communicate to your customer the self-serving, highest, best reason why benefits or advantages that they will reap by transferring their business or their patronage from whomever they are currently doing business with over to you, the more compelling it will be. So this company, this ad agency in New York, was very astute. They would go to prospective clients and say, give us not your most successful product or area. Don't give us the side of your business that's making millions of dollars. Give us your biggest, most thorny problem. Then don't give us a lot of money. Give us a nominal amount. And let us prove by our results that we deserve to handle it. Let us extricate you. Let us make it successful. Only if, when, and after we do that, give us more of the gravy.
I know I'm asking you to dig into your mental filing system. Did any of those successes that that agency had pop to mind?
I'm sorry they don't, but I do know that they ended up representing tons of them. Now, Albert Lasker, who we talked about a number of programs ago, when he got to success, he set up a committee in his agency, and every first Monday of the month, they spent the entire day inviting businesses of all kind, retail, wholesale, distributive, professional, to come in on scheduled basis for free critical evaluations where they could determine whether they could grow the business from a small level to a large one. And they would have like their own. Back then it wouldn't have been called a SWAT team, but a SWAT team who would freely evaluate and analyze and determine what the most probable success mode of growth might be for that business and whether they had the wherewithal to do it and whether the growth potential was meaningful enough that it warranted the two of them considering getting together. And they grew enormous numbers of businesses. Colgate, Palmolive were grown by them, and it was a little company that they couldn't even afford $1,000 to do a test, and they did it for them. Albert Lasker was also very astute in another way. When he saw businesses, he knew not only instinctively but predictably would be growable massively by his system, but if they didn't have the capital, he would finance them because he knew the downside was very low. The upside was almost assured, and he would be bonded to them for a long period of time. And I think a lot of people, they limit and restrict and minimize tremendously the ease with which people can do business because they don't help overcome the limiting, the impeding factors. If you can identify what are the reasons why people don't normally do business with you or don't normally buy your product or service from anybody, and you can lower the barrier of resistance, you can reduce the hurdle by making it easy for them to do it, taking the risk away or the expense away or helping them, knowing predictably that it's not a promiscuous gambit for you, but there's a high probability that on average the vast majority will come through, you'll be made whole, you'll get a great payoff, and you'll get the repeat or the residual benefit. It makes better sense to me, doesn't it, to you, Mark?
It makes a lot of it.
So I'm just sharing some general thoughts, but I learned this from masters. Much, much, much can be learned by studying great people in the past. Again, the reason why was they didn't have the benefit of technology. They didn't have the benefit of impressive packaging. They didn't have the benefit of being able to run expensive television commercials. They didn't have the benefit of being able to show women and sex. They didn't have the benefit of computer graphics. All they had to do was the only benefit they had was their distinctive ability to understand human nature and the immutable laws of humanity and mankind at a higher level than their competitors. And that's an innate, that's a pure, that's a base asset that will not change. And because it's immutable, if you have, you the listener, the subscriber, have the wherewithal to go back in time and study a number of greats, I think you'll be so benefited. And if you'd like, on one of these programs, I'll try to put together an incredible bibliography, and I will also give you the name of a source that is a specialist in preserving and selling old, out-of-print books that they get the rights to reprint at very nominal rates, and I'll give you a library recommendation and that you could probably buy for a few hundred dollars, and you can buy in, you know, in piecemeal if you want to spend $10 or $20 at a time, but it'd be a wonderful, wonderful adjunct. Any one of those books should be worth multiples of 100 times the investment to anybody who will read it, dissect its importance, and apply it. And because I will go through them in one of these calls, if you want, I'll tell people what to look for in the books.
All right, Jay, you have a strategy that you call educate your way to the top. Can we delve into that today?
Yeah, well, it is. I think that you got to realize the more people, basically, we did a session, and again, I'm trying to integrate all these things so that they're cohesive and integrated, not just fragmented. We did a session a couple of weeks back on what I call the strategy of preeminence, and it was based on empowering your customer or prospect, giving them the knowledge, giving them the integrated understanding of how something worked and why it worked and what the interrelationship of everything was, so that it would really, it would and could really pay off in their mind, so they could see the reason why they should act on it. Over the years, I have discovered that the more you teach, the more you explain, the more you illustrate, the more you integrate, the more you overview, the more you share, the more you let people in on the method to the madness, the more expert you make them, the more comfortable they are with a situation or an area or a buying decision. So every time I represent a client, I teach them to do what none of their competitors do, but to tell as much as they can, to share all the critical information that could make a customer or a prospect appreciate, understand, or desire that product at a higher level. For example, there's a lot of things in the course of day-to-day business that business owners take for granted because they've lived with it so long. Everybody in their industry does it. It's a standard operating procedure, but the customer doesn't know that. If you're a retailer, for example, and for you to have the inventory you stock, you have looked at 500 different manufacturers in 40 different categories and tested and evaluated maybe 3,000 different products, 5 or 10 different models of each one or offerings, and put it through a critical self-imposed grid and a criteria of tests to make sure it's the right product or performance attributes to be appropriate for you to sell to your customer. But you never tell your customer that. They don't realize what has been done for them when they go in your store and see, you know, 50 different items or 100 items. They don't know that that's the cream of the cream on a lot of different bases that you've selected from maybe looking at 2,000 items that were substandard by your category. If somebody gets a product you manufacture, they don't know maybe that your engineering specifications are such that that product is designed and manufactured with components and with performance characteristics to last 4 times longer maybe than its competitor, and to have a 10 times lower probability of failure, and to handle stress tolerances or heat or roughhousing by children 3 times. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, I can see where that's very important to implement. How about a couple of examples? Or somebody who was doing this very poorly and you turned around?
Well, we sold $40 million one time of a special kind of insurance by explaining to people the process we went with, that anybody could sell for one company, but one company wasn't always the right decision for you because you may have health problems that certain companies would rate very highly and charge a premium. Other companies might specialize in it and charge the same or less. you may have certain financial constraints that make your ability to pay a certain premium today very difficult, although as you grow it would be easier, and certain companies may have a level premium that didn't approach that. You may have certain needs where today you need much more coverage, but in the future when your kids are grown it's not as important, and there may be a certain company that writes a descending policy that rewards you for not being ill or not dying young by lowering the premium but lowering the coverage, where other ones are level. And the trick is not making you accept what somebody is offering because that's the only choice you've got, but finding the right choice for you. And you can't find the right choice till you basically know all the options. And we did that and sold. We took a company doing $12 million and grew them by that process to $40 million in about, I don't know, 16 months. I took a company in the vitamin business, and by explaining the different performance attributes of certain supplements, what was good, what was bad, what the indications were, why one was more appropriate for a different application in health, in sports, in age than another, we sold millions of dollars worth of vitamins. I did another vitamin program where we created a special program that we had two different programs, one for men and one for women, explaining and educating why the difference in physiology, in age, in lifestyle, in composition, in hormonal compilation in the bodies made all the difference in how different minerals and vitamins and supplements contributed, were assimilated, were utilized, were required. It got people to really appreciate and desire this product at a very high level. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes a lot of sense. How about if someone is starting a business and thinks, how do I do this right so that I don't over-educate people?
Well, let me just say this. Whatever you're selling, if you're selling ice cream, I used ice cream in another example, if everybody, see, your goal is twofold. You want distinction, you want differentiation, you want loyalty, you want higher perceived value and benefit. If you are selling ice cream for $1.25 a cone, and instead of just saying, yeah, if somebody comes in and says, can I have ice cream, and getting them a scoop, if you took the time while you were putting the scoop in and said, you know, this is really very special ice cream. The typical ice cream has, you know, 0.5% butterfat. This has 1.5%. Yet it's 3 calories more, but it makes the taste 10 times richer. It makes the flavor more bountiful. There are ingredients in here that are probably 10 times more expensive than the stuff you'd find in the freezer at the grocery, but it makes it more natural, it makes it more delectable, it makes it 10 times more digestible, and our feeling is if you're going to indulge yourself, you owe it to yourself to have the greatest dessert experience. I mean, you see what I just said? It took 1.5 minutes, but it makes it perceived a lot higher, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you can do it across the board, from the most sophisticated to the most technical to the most mundane, but I think if everybody applies the concept of education to what they are doing, they will find the following things will happen. Number one, the customer or prospect will be more empowered because they'll understand at a critical level and a deeper level and a more integrated level why, the reason why this particular product has more value to them than others. Number two, they'll understand the whole business or the generic area that product comes from at a higher level, and that authority and expertise will give them more confidence, power, and certainty, and they'll be much more bonded. Number three, they will see that product at such a higher level that they will have a higher predisposition or tendency to repurchase that particular company's product on an ongoing basis because they'll see it having much more intangible qualities, if that makes sense.
What strategy would you use to select what you educate a given customer about?
Well, I would keep in mind, the key in influence and persuasion is benefit over features. Features are only useful if you can show the benefit of them. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Let me give you a clear understanding. Most people, you go into a store, and I can tell you this. If I was selling televisions to you or electronic equipment, by me telling you this has got a 20-feature split-screen capacity, that could boggle your mind. If I say that's the features, if I show the benefit, Marty, how'd you like to be able to watch all 7 stations concurrently, and if something really good is happening, be able to zero in on it and bring it up to screen instantly and go back, but always be able to preserve what's happened on the others and come back and watch them? Well, this multi-circuit storage memory 12-function system has that capacity for you. You, remember, you are the key element. Most people are obsessed with selling features. Features are meaningless. Benefits of the features are what life's all about and what selling is all about and what marketing is all about. Most people don't do any effort to connect the features to a transactional result-based benefit it yields to their customer.
If you're starting a business, service business or product, you could almost use that technique ahead of time to design what you're doing.
Well, you almost have to if you want preeminence and dominance and success on a perpetual basis. You almost certainly have to focus your understanding and attention on what is the biggest or what are the composite or what are the spectrum of benefits slash results my product or service or company or efforts produce and render short-term and long-term, tangibly and intangibly, measurably and emotionally for the customer. If you don't sit down this very moment when you're done listening to this interview and you don't make a comprehensive and a detailed and a very, very definitive and finite list that's dimensionalized of all the areas of benefits, of results, of advantages that your product or your service or your company brings to somebody, you are conceding you want to operate hamstrung with one hand and foot, figuratively speaking, tied behind you forever. And that seems ludicrous to run a race with your competitors that way when instead you could unshackle that, give yourself a full lap advantage, and give yourself cleats while they're running with barefooted.
Can you share your perspective on this concept, educating your way to the top, on a repeat business space? What's the most useful way to conceptualize that?
The first conversation you have, you should set the stage. You should educate them. You should illustrate them. You should demonstrate to them. You should help them forge in their mind a keen and a comforting comprehension of the reasons why. Keep using it. The word that will permeate almost everything I'll ever talk to you about, Marty, is reason why. The reason why for their benefit, not yours. They could care about you. If you explain the reason why you do something, you must always redirect it to why you do something, because your desire is to give them, the customer, or them, the prospect, a greater outcome, a greater advantage. You got to refocus your thinking, your thought process, your actions, your communication. But in the beginning, if you set the stage and have them appreciate how, what, and why you do what you do, and more importantly, the why and the that, what you do brings greater advantage and benefit, protection, and result to them, the prospect, from the beginning, you will set them up to value and respect and treasure and desire and commit to you at a higher level than your competitors. Does that make sense?
Makes a lot of sense. Any ideas that pop to mind how this initial setup then resulted in more business down the road?
Well, I mean, it's axiomatic. When I was consulting, I always set the stage. I would never take on a client until I explained to them my take on what they had to commit to do, my take on what they had to see the needs of their customers as being, my take on what their philosophy would be, and the fact that on an ongoing basis we would work together to always put those issues ahead of any other, and at the second stage I would always put their issues ahead of mine, and I would counsel them as if it was my own business, even if that meant at some time in the future telling them not to engage me because I wasn't adding enough value. I would be intolerant of them letting themselves down. I would be ruthless in my focus on what would give them the highest yield. And by doing that, they wanted me at a higher level than they ever would, and they kept coming back because I was consistent with what I set up in the beginning. I would always refer to that and re-electrify that in their mind. I would recall it and advance it, recall it and advance it every time we have dialogue. I mean, what I'm saying is so universal, you'd almost have to give me, as I said, my apologies, but also I'm proud of it. I have so many. Most people that teach don't really do. I think you know that. They maybe did one thing earlier in their life and they've milked it. And I'm not belittling them because there's some fine teachers, but they've milked it for years and years without really having a broad a spectrum of real-life empirical case study experience. I've been involved in 10,000 different businesses probably over the years. I have so many applications, and I never really engaged in them, Marty, with an eye towards making them cases for referencing someday in the future on these programs. So when I talk about it, I'm talking in real, not theory, but real strategy philosophy that I need to be given scenarios to be able to apply, but I hope that they're not abstract to the point where people can't see their implications.
All right. I'm thinking about asking you about components of a typical telephone call for you. If you want to talk about this, educate your way to the top a little more before we do that.
The point is in order to educate your way to the top, you have to identify, understand, recognize, and respect all the value in what you do and how you do it and who does it and what the people doing it for you have put into it. And you've got to, it's almost like what I'll call the fork in the road or the branches of the tree. It just keeps getting deeper and wider and deeper and wider and deeper and wider. And you've got to develop for yourself a discipline or a matrix or a process where you ask yourself a lot of questions. The first question you ask yourself might be, What goes on behind the scenes to make this product or service possible that is extraordinary and dimensional and meaningful and that most people don't understand? In other words, if you've got a computer chip that you go into something, what had to go on for that computer chip to be possible? Did it take 500 scientists working 20-hour days, 4 years of research and development and an estimated $50 million and 10,000 experiments before they were able to perfect this that would base and does this basically what used to cost $4,000 a board and because of the miracles of mass production and syndicating and sharing the cost amongst a million users, now you can bring it down to a nominal cost that you can put it together in the system and it can sell it for $500, but it can help this $500 item can now accomplish and perform the job that a year ago took a $5,000 or $50,000 item and 10 people. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, let me give you a scenario, and if you could apply the technique here. A few months ago, I ran into a young individual who was starting out on creating musical compositions for whoever would pay for them. How would he apply the concept of education?
Well, who would his customer be?
A lot of times a corporate client who wanted a jingle or some kind of musical theme.
I think the first thing he'd want to do is educate people. First of all, he'd have to learn. Sometimes you've got to do some research in your own clinicals before you're ready to educate because you aren't skilled enough or knowledgeable enough or educated enough on your own to realize the reason why what you offer is so valuable. So sometimes, and I would imagine he would have to do the same thing. He might start in his skill set of making a list of all the experiences he's had that gives him the ability to represent them. First of all, he might have gone to college for 6 years and studied under the most masterful people who have composed songs and lyrics and jingles and music that has, and he's going to document the results, that have sold 50 million copies, that have moved, $200 million worth of merchandise that have. So he's got to sell you on what the knowledge or the past performance or the people who influenced him might have done. Then he might do some research and see what studies clinically might exist to show the difference that the right kind of what music does to the mind, what music does to the receptivity, what music does to correlate and conjure up images that are positive and conducive to a desired buying result, and what the researchers who are highly respected, maybe at Harvard or at Stanford or at MIT, have discovered about music's integral importance in predisposing the people, and that they're four times more probable to buy when they are set in the right mood, and the right mood is a function of perhaps having the right alpha orientation, and the alpha orientation evolves from a melodic sequence of this and this and this and this, and it's not just the ability to write music, it's a certain composition of the way music is written. Does that make sense?
Yes. Could you talk a little bit more about an individual having to do research to understand what is valued about what he does?
I think I was sharing with you yesterday or in a previous session the background of Claude Hopkins and one of his axioms that is irrefutable, and that is that generalities and platitudes fall off people's believability mind like water falls off the back of a duck. Specifics, clinicals, measurable, comparable, contrastable facts are immutable. That being said, most people don't have powerful facts. You've got to ask the right questions of people who are in a position to know. In your scenario, which is a very challenging scenario, I would have that man go to anybody who has ever done research on music, and then I'd categorize all the implications. What have they learned about music's impact on people? What correlation do they know? What has anybody, and there must be an industry association, there must be departments at big colleges, and a lot of these people will tell you the answers. If they don't, there might be a lot of research grad students who would be excited to work on that project as part of their thesis. But normally, the manufacturer or the source has already done most of or some of or more than you need, and by sharing and interviewing them or garnering their work or their research or their raw footage or their data and analyzing it, you can uncover integrated facts and implications that give you some tremendous advantage and give validity and powerful distinction to the, again, reason why what you do or how you do it makes sense. A lot of people who sell products, I have them go to their manufacturers and ask the, and talk to the research and the engineering or the chief chemist or the chief production man and find out about how they buy the materials and what the components and what the engineering stats are and where the components come from and what the how many pieces they reject to find, you know, to end up with the quality performance standards that they have and how much engineering went into it and how often they redo it and what their research and development is like to keep improving upon it and what's happened over the years. So they have a story to tell, so when you get something, you're not just buying a something, you're buying the history, you're buying the expertise, you're buying the rarities, you're buying the disciplines, you're buying all kinds of performance characteristics that have gone into it, and you're buying, you know, the PhD engineers and the unrelenting, non-compromising quality control people, and the buyer who goes, remember, it was pretty interesting. They showed, there was a commercial years ago for Juan Valdez with coffee, and they showed him trekking in the mountains, looking at hundreds of coffee bean samples before he picked the right ones for his coffee.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was very powerful, don't you think?
Yeah.
Same thing. That was instantaneous, but he did it in 10 seconds. Some things may take 10 minutes.
All right, and we can still remember that these years past.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I was thinking about a person who's thinking about starting up the sideline business or a new business, has maybe just an inkling. And my guess, Jay, is that a lot of people don't really know what their most valuable skills are, their hidden assets are.
If you like, and again, I keep saying this, but I can do a session where we take people on a personal asset, a hidden asset inventory treasure hunt, where I do for about an hour a short course distillation. I have a philosophy and a strategy I call Your Secret Wealth, and it's a philosophy that demonstrates to people that every human being in any place on the continuum, whether you own a business, whether you're an adult, whether you're a child, whether you're you are working, not working, retired, own the business, are a low level employee of the business, have within your life, within your skill set, within your abilities, within your past experiences, within your context, within your relationships, within your hobby, within your natural skills, enormous breadths and depths of hidden wealth and riches that you must only identify to be able to tap. That everybody is richer than they think, and I'll be glad to go through it. It's a 6-hour process, but I can probably condense it into about an hour or so in one of these calls if you'd like.
All right, yeah, I think we ought to...
Call your hidden wealth inventory, and that's what it goes through.
All right. Before we leave the subject, it seems to me like as we think about educating yourself to the top, in a way you have to educate yourself in order to be able to educate your customer, your client.
That's exactly right. You have to first educate yourself. See, if you aren't passionate about what you teach, you, I mean, also, understand, if you believe in the philosophy of education, you must believe that your destiny and your job and your challenge and your purpose is to be an educator, shouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
So you're the
mm-hmm.
ultimate teacher. You can't teach if you don't have conviction, or you'll be a hypocrite, wouldn't you?
Yes. Yeah.
So you've got to be committed to a philosophy of natural curiosity and perpetual discovery about yourself, about your product, about the people who support the product. Don't you want to know if your technicians working for you have on average 20 years worth of experience, if they've worked on average 100,000 units, if they've dealt with 487 unrelated problems that occur, and all you've ever heard of is 500 that ever concur, if they on average have dealt with every problem successfully, wouldn't you want to have that kind of person working on your unit instead of somebody who's never dealt with it and only been in the business for a year?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you got to understand the reason why that makes sense to you. And all things being equal, if one person's charging you $52 an hour to repair your whatever, and he or she is using nouveau graduates of tech schools, and the other person is charging $52, but he's got on average 10-year masters with 20,000 hours worth of frontline experience with 500 different problems. Which would you rather have working, both for comfort and security, and also for expediency of result?
Well, not a difficult choice.
No, but you can't make that choice if you're not educated to recognize that those distinctions exist.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Jay, let's make just a bit of a transition here. You mentioned one time in a program that you could tell us how you do a phone call, and by implication, I mean, this is kind of a secret of yours, how to analyze a problem, and I thought maybe we might be able to apply it to our own situations. How do you deal on a phone call?
I've never in my life shared or articulated this before, so I'm conceptualizing it, sharing it, defining it, codifying it, and verbalizing it for the first time. So indulge me and bear with me, Marty. When I have a telephone conversation with a consulting client, a prospective contingency client, or a short little what I'll call hot seat session that I do at my training programs, a process occurs. The first thing I do is I ask the person to tell me the business he is or she is in. I ask them what the product or service or services they render are. I ask them to define for me the scope of their operation. I ask them to tell me who their customer is and define them and what they buy and how what they buy interacts or applies to their life or business. I ask them to tell me how they have built the business predominantly to date through what device. Then I have them define their definition and interpretation of what that device is. In other words, they might say, well, we've done it through direct marketing. And I want to know what direct marketing means to them, because there are probably 20 different modes of direct marketing. They might say referral programming. I want to know what referral programming means, how they do it, what systematized or ad hoc programming they do. I want to know what they have learned in all the time they've been doing this. What has worked best for them? What has not worked? What they have not done? I want to know what their competitors do. I want to know the pricing so I know what the margins are. I want to know as close as they can tell me to what the marginal net worth or lifetime value profit dynamics are of a transaction, of a customer. If it's prospect-based, how many prospects do they generate? What does a prospect cost them to generate? How many prospects convert to sales? I need to know all of that before I can figure out an intelligent approach to take. Once I do figure that out, I then start looking at better possibilities to get a better result for the same or less money or broader response from the marketplace. I try to look at what we can do to make the marketplace desire my prospective client's product or service at a higher level. What benefits or advantages or greater results or risk reversals we can give. And I ask lots of questions, and I'm testing, doing trial balloons, trying to see what the marketplace that they serve needs and wants and desires best. I try to find out whatever programming and critical mass of marketing capital they have in momentum, what velocity is already taking place. Are they running ads? If they run ads, what do the ads say? How do they run them? Where do they run them? What do they spend? I want to know how much more leverage I can give to each one. When those ads run, what happens? If people call in, what do they say? What do they do? Do they follow up? I want to know how many functions they fail to do that by just changing or adding or improving the process, I can give instant leverage. I want to know what they do with their customers on a communication basis. Do they write them? Do they call them? Do they visit them? Do they mail them? Do they have special events? Do they have programs? I want to look at everything they do or don't do, and when they do, I want to know how many ways they do it. If they don't do it, I want to know if they can do it, and I'm putting together a customized fabric all along. Does that make sense?
Makes sense. How about a quick little scenario? Let's say I called you up and I'm just getting started or thinking about starting a business. How would it apply to a scenario like that? What would you say on the telephone?
Well, I would say things like this. First of all, I want to know what your skills are. I'd want to know what your objective is. I'd want to know what your financial and your working and your conceptual goals are. In other words, how much money are you trying to make? Are you trying to get retired? Are you trying to basically, how much time do you want to invest? What do you enjoy doing? What do you think this will do for you? What do you want to do for the marketplace? Why do you think this business is best for you? How much money do you have? Can you afford, for it to be a nurturous long-term payout? Does it have to make money right away? What are you really good at? What are you bad at? And I'd want to evaluate all your options once I learn the basis through which. In other words, you may have a lot of people going into business for themselves are not very discriminating. By that I mean they'll fall for the first idea that comes to them because they're so conceptually desperate. They won't evaluate options. I got a great education one time from a man who was a master at teaching people all about rental property, how to buy homes, single-family homes, and rent them out.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a really great adage and a great dictum. He said, do not buy any rental property until you first looked at 100. Because if you decide you're going to go into rental property, your inclination is going to be to buy the first property you look at. You should do the opposite. You should look at 100 first because you'll see how many more opportunities, how many more benefits, how much more advantageous pricing, how many more possibilities there are out there, and it'll give you the spectrum. Unless you've given yourself a full spectrum of the options, the possibilities, the advantages, the disadvantages, the flexible options you've got available, you can't make the best decision. I mean, keep in mind, the goal in everything we would ever do together, everything you would ever do for yourself, everything you should ever do for anyone else is you want to get the highest and best current, future, and ongoing leverage out of every decision you make. If you make the wrong decision about a business and you put a business together and you put money and time and human capital into the wrong business, a business that has less probability of succeeding, less probability of making you a lot of money, less probability of fulfillment for you, less probability of being self-sustaining, less probability of being worth something when you're tired of it, than an option that you could have taken instead but that you didn't allow yourself to know about, that's pretty sad, isn't it?
It is. I have a question for you right after we come back on Side 2 of The Wizard's Edge with Jay Abraham. Jay, you talked briefly there about a person out of conceptual barrenness taking the first thing that came along. Is that a typical problem you deal with client after client?
Lots of people. Probably 80% of the people. Keep in mind, most of my work is with people who are already operating in a business. But they've made a decision. I mean, if they came to me and said, should I stay in that business? And I could click my heels and transfer the years, the time, the capital they've made, they've invested into something else. 80%, I'd say no. Go into a better business that'll give you more leverage. But I'm forced to deal with the realities of the situation where they may have 12 years invested, all their life invested, their mortgage of their house invested, a lease for 20 years, a building they own, and my charge is to make the most of a bad situation. If people come to me in the beginning, before they have inextricably made a commitment that compromises their life, I look at it very differently. I look at it with a very, very ruthless eye to what's in their best interest, short, long-term, on all the criteria I said. A lot of people don't really want a job, but that's what they buy, is a horrible job that they can never even take time off of. And I want to make sure that they understand the pros, the cons, the options they have available. I am not in a hurry to see people jump into something, particularly franchises, particularly new ideas, One time, a person paid me, years ago, I used to get $2,000 instead of $3,000 an hour. They gave me $2,000 an hour to counsel them on how to make a fad idea they wanted to manufacture successful. And I took their money and I said, I'm going to give you the greatest benefit I can. I'm going to give you something else to do with your energy and your time and the capital, because what you're doing now has about a 99% probability of not working. I'd rather show you how to take the same time, the same effort, the same enthusiasm and capital, and put it into an enterprise that had a 90% probability of working. And I can't always do that with people who already committed themselves to a career or to a business.
Do you know if those people took your advice there?
It's been so long. I believe they did, and I believe they wrote me, and I believe they thanked me, and I believe they made a lot of money. But as I said, this is quite funny. Unlike many people you may interview, Marty, I have so many actual clients, case studies, and success stories that they become hazy. I've been doing this for so long, and I have thousands of people who have successfully applied these techniques. I can't always remember the outcome after I do it.
Well, most people's successes are so rare, it's easy to remember them, Jay.
Well, that's what happens. I mean, I've counseled a lot of speakers who speak publicly, and they have the same basic success stories they recant and they utter all the time, because that's all they really have. I didn't get into this field with a conscious desire to record and catalog all the successes. I got in this just to help people, and oftentimes I'm brought in for very intense blitzes where I'll do 3 or 4 hours or a day, and then I'll never talk to somebody again. So it gets a little bit hazy, and as I said, I've been doing this for years, so I'm sorry I don't always have clear answers.
Well, we're getting a lot of your best strategies and concepts. We'll go ahead and go out and make some money and write you a letter, and then you can forget us.
That would be very nice.
Let's talk about barter. This is an area that I think intrigues people somewhat, but very few people have the expertise to do it, let alone understand it.
Okay, let's talk about barter. Barter is probably the most overlooked profit center opportunity everybody in any kind of business can have. It can be a business to go into. It can be an extension of your business. There are probably 100 ways you can use it profitably. I have either bartered or directed barter activities to the tune of probably $100 million for clients over the years. It is very legal. It need not be done covert. It should not be done covert. All it is, in fact, is a means by which you can take any product or service you create that has margin, and whatever that margin is, you can use that margin to acquire goods or services your business wants or needs, or you and your life want or need, and buy them at a discount equal to or exceeding whatever the spread of your business is. And that's a pretty powerful, powerful, powerful opportunity. You can create purchasing power at will. You can buy goods and services you need or want all day long at discounts of whatever your margins are. In other words, if you produce a product and your margins are 60% and you need to buy a product or service, you can go out and barter your product or service for that, or barter to a third person to get to that and end up getting the product. Let's say you needed $10,000 worth of carpet.
Okay.
And let's say you manufactured furniture.
Okay.
And your furniture, $10,000 worth of your furniture at retail cost you $2,000. At wholesale.
Okay.
If you go to a carpet company, a retailer or a manufacturer, and you go to them and say, I will trade you $10,000 worth of my furniture for $10,000 worth of your carpet, you just acquired $10,000 worth of carpet that if you went into the outside market, you would probably pay $10,000 worth for $2,000. You have a choice when you do that of either using it internally and saving $8,000, or turning it into a profit center and selling that carpet to a third party for a discount over market value and making 300 or 400% on the transaction. Pretty interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's totally, it's not the way I was thinking at all.
You can barter goods, you can barter services, you can barter one-on-one, you can barter in what I call triangulation. You may want something, I may have what you want, but I may not want what you've got, but you may be able to find somebody, a third party, that has what I want, and by trading that third party, your product for theirs or your product for their services, and trading their services to me, you get what you want at a discount. Does that make sense?
Well, it does in an abstract way. You're going to have to be a little more concrete.
Why don't I give you, I think I can come up with probably, 15 really simple ways that anybody could use barter. It's a good starting point. You want me to try to share those?
Yeah, please do.
Okay, well, let me give you the first one. You can use barter to save cash on capital expenditures. Say you're buying a computer. After you've negotiated the lowest price possible, you agree to the price if the seller will take a portion of that negotiated price in your product or services, ideally 25 to 50%. What will that accomplish? It just lowered the true cost of that computer to you by, let's say, one-third, and gave you dating on the barter portion of the purchase because you don't necessarily have to give them your product or service right now. A lot of people can't use it right now, while allowing you to pay for it later interest-free. If you became really good at trading, you can probably get a higher percentage trade, sometimes 100%. You could even trade a lesser dollar value of your more valuable services or products for a larger dollar value of computers. The interesting thing in barter is if you've got something very valuable and I have something less valuable, you can make me give you multiples or many times or a fraction higher of my products to you if you're going to give me yours, so you even get greater margin. Does that make sense?
Yeah, let's
give you a good example. Car dealers. Cars have a lot more desirability than radio advertising. You're in the radio business.
Okay.
If I was a car dealer and you were a radio station and you needed a car either for your news department or for yourself or for your wife, and I needed advertising, but I didn't necessarily want it as bad as you wanted a car.
Okay.
I could go to you and say, I know you need a car, Marty. I have a car that sells for $20,000. You have radio advertising, but $20,000 worth of your radio advertising isn't worth $20,000 worth of my cars. I will trade you a $20,000 car for $60,000 worth of your radio advertising. Now, why would you be inclined to do that? Because, as you and I both know, incrementally, if your radio station is not sold out, $60,000 worth of your radio time costs you virtually nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Does it?
Right.
You could get a $20,000 car for zero. I, on the other hand, if I am advertising anyhow, I just got $60,000 worth of advertising on your station for $20,000 less whatever my fixed cost is. And on a car, it's not that much. It's like 12, 18% less, but let's say 18%. So instead of $20,000, the hard cost of that car to the dealer would be, what, $16,000,
$17,000?
Yes. But if he got three or four times that value in advertising, that's better than buying $20,000 worth of advertising for cash, isn't it?
Wow, yes.
Another approach that car dealers do is they will give you the use of the car for 3 years for $60,000, but they will retain ownership, so at the end of 3 years, they get it back, and they've cut the cost to you. I mean, they've cut their cost down in half because the car probably still is worth $10,000 at the end of 3 years.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you can save cash on capital expenditures.
Okay.
Bartering increases a business's total sales. Since many businesses focus a lot of attention on total gross, barter accentuates the gross while continuing to minimize the overhead, which means that the cost of producing barter, instead of paying with 100% dollars, enables you to increase your gross sales at a fraction of what it would be with cash. Consequently, your bartered sales could be many times more profitable than cash. Keep in mind, if your business can only, on a typical cash basis, selling your products or services for cash to the marketplace, do X, but by adding barter, you could do 3X, and by doing 3X, you increase your buying power massively and lower your cost of goods, that barter transaction could make you more profit than the transactions you normally do, particularly, again, when you do barter, you have two options always, three options. You can barter for goods or services the business normally uses and would pay cash for, right?
Okay.
You can barter for goods or services you or anybody in your family or in your company could normally get and pay cash for. There was a company one time, a radio station, who bartered with Chrysler. They bartered with Chrysler for 25 Chrysler automobiles. They had no use for them, but what they did, they were able to trade whatever 25 times 20 was at $500,000 of the radio advertising that cost them nothing. They got control of 25 cars. The station owner and his son took two. The other 23, they put a sign up in their in their lunchroom and offered the cars to their employees at 30% less than they could buy them in the dealerships, and they sold them all in a week. They gave 30% savings to their employees, but they put $400,000 in their pockets.
Wow.
The fourth thing is you can buy it as a profit center. That was a profit center, but you could use it for your own account too. You can use it as a profit center. You could go outside and sell the cars or trade the cars for something else you needed.
Okay.
An infinite number of possibilities, but you can use barter to increase your total sales. A third way you can use barter is it lets you pay operating expenditures, even payroll, with soft dollars. This means you could be low on or even out of cash and still continue to operate your business and prosper by paying people in goods and services, paying contractors in goods and services, paying suppliers in goods and services.
Before you're done with this, I want you to tell people how to approach this either in person or maybe a letter. But go ahead with the list you have.
Okay. Number four, you can print your own currency or script, which is usable only at your place of business. The advantages and benefits of having your own legal tender are limited only by your imagination, Marty. Here's just an example. Say there's something your company really needs or wants to acquire, but you can't afford it on a cash-paying basis. By using your own printed barter currency, where the cost is based on the cost of supplying the goods and services, and where you take delivery now but pay for it much, much later, you could afford to acquire whatever is needed. Give me an example. There was a prominent restaurant in Los Angeles that was in a cash flow bind. It was very successful, but it was in a cash flow bind. They needed to remodel. They went to somebody, and they got somebody to furnish them with $60,000 worth of carpeting, painting, and the like, and they gave them $60,000 worth of script, of actual certificates they printed. They got the $60,000 worth of remodeling right now. The other people got $60,000 worth of script that they couldn't possibly use at one time. So besides paying the $60,000 with future services at a discount, because the cost of food is about one-third of its retail, the cost of wine is maybe one-fourth of the retail.
Mm-hmm.
So besides getting $60,000 worth of remodeling for at most $12,000 in hard cost, they were able to defer paying that $12,000 for months because the person who traded used about $2,000 a month. They couldn't use it. They couldn't use $60,000 in a month.
Pretty hard to do.
So they got to pay for it long-term, interest-free. What bank will let you borrow $60,000, pay them back $12,000 without interest, and call the debt even?
Okay, let me throw a wrench into that. What happens if the remodeling service gave out the script and everybody came that month?
Okay, what's the worst thing that happens? It costs you $12,000
okay.
to have bought $60,000 worth of... First of all, statistically, it's improbable.
Mm-hmm.
But if it did, what's the worst thing that happened? If I said to you, Marty, you're going to have this cash flow bind for a month, but in order to, if you'll accept that, I can get you $60,000 worth of desperately needed remodeling that you'll have to pay $60,000 for $12,000, and the odds of it costing you the full 12 right now are about 1 in 1,000.
Okay.
I mean, think about it. Statistically,
tremendous deal.
Well, but it's, I mean, everyone's got it available. I'm just sharing how some very savvy people that I know make their buying power, make their capital expand, create purchasing power at will, reduce their cost of goods and services by far less than the cost of manufacturing, enrich and expand their lifestyle or their business lifestyle at a level you can't believe, and have a lot of fun in the process.
Okay.
As I said, automatically get you terms, credit, discounts far better and easier than you could by paying cash. You issue $5,000 of credit to a printer. He gives you $5,000 worth of printing and delivers it to you up front, right away, immediately. You pay with your barter script credits, giving the printer 1 to 2 years to use his credit. The longer you give them to use it, the less value it costs you to fulfill, because $5,000 worth of value today is going to be $5,000 in 2 years is less value, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Unless, you know, so it's improbable that prices are going to go down. They're only going to go up, Marty.
Right.
So it's incredible. It gets you the chance to finance purchases at a steep discount, pay for the purchases interest-free, and more often than not even have to pay the full agreed-upon discount price, because most people don't use all the barter credits you give them, even though they're fully entitled to.
All sorts of discounts there.
Number five is breakage. The same thing. Breakage represents the barter certificates you issue when you trade with someone that are never used. A certain percentage of all barter credits issued, if they have an expiration date, which we recommend, will not be used. An example, a very prominent major hotel in New Orleans traded $125,000 worth of radio and TV time once, and they issued barter script in that amount with a one-year expiration date. Right up front, the hotel got $125,000 in advertising for the hotel at regular cash rates. That was advertising they had already normally agreed to pay $125,000 for. At the end of the 12 months, they performed an audit by the controller, and it revealed that only $35,000 at face value worth of the barter script had been redeemed within the time period allowed. The rest expired unused. The hotel was perfectly prepared to honor it, but historically, people don't get around to using it. The cash cost of the hotel delivering $35,000 worth of goods, rooms, etc., was only $5,000. The hotel had leveraged up $125,000 worth of advertising for $5,000 in real cost. However, that doesn't take into consideration two overlooked but extremely significant hidden profit factors. Statistically, $35,000 in room trade produces $17,500 in cash, food, beverage, and miscellaneous sales for the hotel, with a gross profit that would be in excess of $8,000. So the hotel actually got paid $3,000 net-net after all costs to enter into the trade. That's taking the $8,000 of revenue less the $5,000 cost to fulfill in the room. Pretty interesting, isn't it?
Wow, that's fascinating.
All $35,000 worth of rooms were not used at one time also. It was spread over 12 months, meaning that the hotel got to pay the $5,000 in hard costs over 12 months totally interest-free. In essence, they got $125,000 worth of advertising up front and got paid $3,000 plus deferred interest to do so. It's pretty interesting, isn't it?
That's terrific.
Want to hear more?
Please.